Okay, I want to sort of start with a small preamble, about 3 minutes worth. I didn't really plan on giving this talk when I came to this workshop, but I think this idea grew basically in the middle of last week, and in all these discussions there were sparked off by Bernie Schulz's call to arms, so to say, you know, that all of us should contribute to this timely problem of numerical relativity. And I particularly was very, I think, on the same wavelength as Charlie, and very much inspired by that, by the remark that he made, which is that, well, nobody is going to drop what they're doing and suddenly start working on this problem, but maybe we want to keep this problem in mind and add twists to what one is doing. And this seminar is very much in that spirit, basically. So the issue I want to restrict myself is really the following. It is this issue of extracting physics from the strong field region. And again, there was this little bit of a tension or perhaps misunderstanding between analytical people and numerical people. And analytical people said, well, what are you plotting? And numerical people wanted to say, well, don't ask that question, rather tell us what we should plot. So this is really in the spirit of perhaps providing some ideas about what one should be plotting, for example. And the basic idea is the following, that I think Mijan alluded to this already in his talk. We want to extract physics in the strong field region near the horizon. And sort of a concrete example is that we have this nice mathematical framework at infinity, which ADM provided for us almost 40 years ago, and then at null infinity, which Bondi and Penrose and Newman and others and Sachs provided us almost the same number of years ago, at least 35 years ago. And that framework has given a lot of intuition to us about, you know, how to think physically about what is happening, particularly the peeling theorems, what are asymptotic symmetries, what do we mean by mass, what do we mean by flux of energy, and why we should think of Psi-4 as measure of carrying some information about the energy that is going out, and so on. And so the idea is that, well, if that is outer boundary, should we not do something similar at the, so to say, an inner boundary of the space-time, which one would like to compute, and the inner boundary would be the horizon. And in fact, the similarities are rather, you know, quite striking. I mean, they have sky and horizon are null surfaces, and maybe we just didn't look at enough structure of the horizon. And if we looked at the structure of the horizon, maybe there will be a framework exactly like the framework we have at Sky, and we'll be able to extract a lot of physical quantities. And so that is the general spirit, and I think one has, as I hope I'll be able to present to you, some results which show that one can indeed go along these lines. The work I'm going to present here is sort of, I'm picking various results that were obtained jointly with two students, Chris Beetle and Steve Ferris at Penn State, and Jurek Lewandowski at Goldman at Warsaw. Again, some of you might have followed this talk. I've given talks on isolated horizon before. This really is much more recent work. Most of it is not published. We're just writing it up. There is one reference which is on a very restricted case that I'll talk about, which is just up here in CQG, and it is available as GRQC. So CQG, classic quantum gravity, the paper may have appeared, is going to appear in the February issue, and the GRQC is there was a letter on the subject in CQG also last February, so a year ago. Okay. Just caution, I mean, I'm not, this framework is really like what happens at null infinity, if you like, in the same spirit. So it's not that it's immediately, you know, tomorrow one might be able to compute something, I mean, few things one would actually be able to compute, but certainly one would not be able to compute everything one wants to compute. Some work would be clearly needed in translating what is doing one, the quote-unquote exact analytical notions that arise in this framework and what one does in numerical relativity, you know, the approximations that go in by the very fact that one is doing numerical relativity. It's very similar to what one does with ADM mass. I mean, ADM mass is defined at infinity. One knows lots of its property, but of course, we have finite grid size, and then we have to sort of say what we mean by ADM mass. So there will be some similar approximations that will have to be done, and so therefore, I think one needs really a dialogue between analytical people and numerical people about what is going to be most useful. Okay. So that's basically the I mean, I sort of feel that this is very much in the spirit of the workshop of starting and continuing dialogues between the two communities. So the organization of this seminar would be as follows. The first part, I'll tell you what are isolated horizons, why one is interested in them, some motivation and the definition, if you like. Then in the second part, I'll tell you some general structure of isolated horizons. Then I'll talk about mass and angular momentum, formulae for mass and angular momentum of this horizon. And then finally, I'd like to say something about future directions or applications. And again, I would very much appreciate sort of input from both the communities. So why, or the motivation for this, is really so this really grew out of issues which don't really touch on numerical relativity, but as we'll see in a minute, that the similar kind of issues arise also in numerical relativity. And the original motivation was really that to sort of obtain a more sort of more physical, and I explain what I mean by that. Approach to black hole mechanics, laws of black hole mechanics that have been sort of celebrated laws that we have. And the second was sort of a full non-perturbative calculations of black hole and of quantum calculations of black hole entropy. That's where it really began. And why do I say that why do we need more physical approach? Well, if we look at most of the literature in mathematical relativity, the theorems or solutions or deep analysis really assumes, usually when one says of horizon, as Bob Wald told us, that very little actually is known outside the context of really event horizons. And this could be dynamical or non-dynamical or stationary, and killing horizons. And the laws of black hole mechanics, one actually assumes both, that one is given a horizon, which is actually a killing horizon. And then, for example, when one writes down the first law, that delta M is equal to kappa upon 8 pi g times delta area, plus work terms, one typically means this mass is really the ADM mass. But clearly, if you have a physically realistic situation in which some collapse occurred, then, generic collapse and a really two-body problem, which is our multiple body problems up here, in which there may be some significant amount of radiation that is let out, then clearly the mass of the black hole is not the ADM mass, because there is also radiation which went out. And the question is, well what is this mass? So one would like to say that, well, somehow, even though people use ADM mass, they really don't mean it. One should really mean some local thing. But the question is, well, what is this? So we would like to sort of generalize this, and then what is this object? And similarly, kappa here is the surface gravity. That is to say, is the acceleration of the null normal to the horizon. And this is, in the non-rotating case, this is taken to be the acceleration of that killing vector field, which is unit at infinity. So surface gravity also refers to quantities at infinity. And somehow I think that doesn't look right, because if you don't have a global killing vector field, kappa then won't be well defined, and then what do I do? So what one would hope is that maybe these quantities can be defined in some quasi-local fashion just around the horizon, and we will see that is the case. So what is the basic idea? The basic idea is to consider, for example, I'll have these two pictures here. Either it could be a gravitational collapse, in which a horizon forms, and maybe there's a lot of radiation which is going out to infinity. But you might expect that at late times, the horizon settles down. So this horizon is expanding, is dynamical. But at late times, you might expect that it settles down. And you might want to consider that part of the horizon which has settled down, which is not expanding anymore. And so even though in the full physical space-time, of course, there will be a lot of radiation which is going out all the way. So this little wedge of space-time that I have drawn up here is not really, is not stationary, it's not static. There's a lot of radiation up here. So there's no Killing vector field in the space-time. But the horizon itself is isolated. No radiation is not falling in the horizon at late times. Or you might have our favorite scenario that is being considered here in great detail of two black holes, and then they collapse, they collide, and then they form a horizon. And again, you would expect that in distant future up here, things settle down, and when they are settled down, then one would imagine I could take a space-like surface like that, for example. Take a space like that, and you would imagine that when it's settled down, this horizon is isolated. So things are not falling across this horizon. Now,
what is the difference with the distortion? Usually, people have in mind that things settle down, right, which means in the non-conformal picture, all the wave-like structure goes to infinity,
right,
and therefore there is a large domain. Yes, and this thing, but if I do the sphere, ordinary space, then there is this thing where everything is quasi-static, and I have a Killing horizon, and I do an approximation where ADN is before.
Right. So
that
2 points.
Are you going to allow more wave content than the ordinary thing?
Okay. So there are issues about two points here. One is, what can one do in general, in other words, as mathematical relativity, and then is two applications. And let me just talk in two sentences. Well, you can use solutions such as Robinson-Trautmann solution, which actually has a horizon, okay? It has a horizon, the solution looks bad. This is a horizon, but there is radiation in every neighborhood of the horizon. Okay? But the horizon is isolated, nothing is actually falling into the horizon. And general considerations based on the null initial value formulation of Helmholtz and Allen Reynolds modifications thereof and so on, suggests that there are lots of such solutions. Okay? So from a mathematical relativity point of view, one wants to incorporate such solutions. From a more physical point of view, you're right, that one would expect that all these things are going out here. But still, there's no real Killing vector in the whole space-time, and the problem that I was talking about of really computing the mass out here is not right. So one needs to know what the mass up here is. And typically, one would have to take this space-time and embed it in an appropriate Kerr space-time geometry. What one would like to do is, I mean, we don't do that when we sort of talk about mass at null infinity, for example. We don't say, well, find appropriate space-time, which is, if you like, the appropriate space-time is to begin with Minkowski space out there. But we just said, well, compute the following quantities, the Weyl tensor, the bond, the shear dot, etc. These are quantities defined in the physical space-time, and then the mass is just given in terms of that. So what one would like is, from a practical point of view, I mean, certainly when these people evolve, right, I mean, they get space-times in some coordinate system, it doesn't look anything like Kerr. And then there are a lot of problems in trying to understand how to embed this space-time, even though physically it is similar to that. So one would like to avoid that problem. So one would like to be able to give you, I would like to be able to give you a formula, say that mass is, compute the mass by computing the following quantities right here, without embedding, in any coordinate system you want, there's a mathematical relativity point of view and a more physical point of view. Okay. So the statement is that this event horizon notion, as we all know, is basically too global. In numerical relativity, sort of, it's obvious that you would never want to evolve really to complete infinity and really get the event horizon, because it is too. Would you like to? Oh, start looking at Peter Hoover, right? Okay, take it back. Progress, that's right. But in general, I mean, it is just a too global statistic. In other words, you don't want to wait till you have the whole space-time and then you do ray tracing and find this. And we would like to have something which is quasi-local. So we would like something which is and secondly, you would like something which does not have Killing vector field. In other words, the horizon is isolated, or if you like, the geometry of the horizon may be time-independent, but there is no Killing vector field. So this is what one would like to do, and I want to say that that's what one wants in numerical relativity also. You don't want to assume that there is, I just explained in answer to Thibault's question, you don't want these embedding problems and so on. So you just want to understand a situation in which the object that you're talking about is really isolated. Now just let me run ahead of myself. I'll come back to this in the last part, discussion part. But if in fact in these evolutions, one has taken these apparent horizons, and one really found the apparent horizons, and you time evolve them, then in these late times, the equilibrium situations, you'll find this apparent horizon would be very, very close to the event horizon, and it actually would be null, and that is the object that I want to look at, basically. Okay? But without talking about the event horizon, because you really have found it. So the world lines of the apparent horizon, the time evolution of the apparent horizon would be an isolated horizon. Time evolution of the apparent horizon at late times would be an example of isolated horizon. Okay. So now, what do we want to do here? Definition, right? Yeah. So the isolated horizons are going to be locally defined. They will allow radiation, and they will capture the idea that the black hole itself is isolated or non-dynamical, although there may be radiation or dynamics outside. And just one idea, and then the one idea is, how are we going to get the definitions of mass and the angular momentum? And the basic idea is to do a Hamiltonian formulation. And what will happen, roughly, is that when you do this Hamiltonian formulation, you will get the generator of the appropriate time translation on the phase, the gravitational phase space along the lines of the ADM will have a volume term. The volume term will be just constraints. There will be term at infinity that will give us the ADM for momentum or ADM energy or ADM mass, depending on what you plug in. And then there will be a surface integral also at the horizon. And the mass and angular momentum of the horizon will be read out of this surface integral. That is the general idea. Of course, we have to make a lot of checks about, is this a reasonable definition? That's what we'll do. Okay, so now as Thibault says, real business, and that is, what is it? The definition. So the definition is just the following. So it is first of all a manifold, which is topologically S2 cross R. In the mathematical relativity applications, you can easily replace this S2 by any compact manifold. And then in the results that I'm doing, there is one or two places where actually we had to use the Gauss-Bonnet theorem, and there the numerical coefficients will change depending on which one topology is. But other than that, the general framework is not sensitive to that topology. But for a numerical relativity, the most interesting case is this, so that's what I'll assume. So the first condition is that, so this somehow wanted to find some letter, and since this is really a little part of the whole horizon, it was called delta, and now that notation is stuck, so we were just calling this the boundary to be delta. So an isolated horizon is, first of all, three-manifold, which is topologically S2 cross R. And it is null. Then we want to assume that whatever field equations you have, and for numerical relativity at least at the moment, these will be just Einstein's equations. But this whole framework has been done, for example, with general sources like Einstein-Maxwell theory, Dilettante couplings, which are sort of peculiar, which are some fun things of their own, and also Young-Mills couplings. And Young-Mills actually is something interesting happens where there really are hairy black holes, so the black hole uniqueness theorem are not valid there. So all these cases actually have been done, but it's not relevant for numerical relativity. So I'll just restrict myself. I won't. For the detailed formula I'll write down, I will just ignore all of the charges and look at just the vacuum case, basically. So the field equations hold at delta. So just on the points of delta, the field equations hold. And if there is a stationary tensor, we're going to assume that the energy condition, that if you take this null direction field that we have got here, L, which is normal to the horizon, then we are going to assume that this is future directed. So this energy condition is satisfied. This is a very weak, in a non-technical sense, a very weak energy condition. It's weaker than. So these are sort of very simple things. And the meat, of course, of the isolated horizon condition are these two conditions. The first condition is that this surface vanishes. vanishes on the horizon on delta. So these are just boundary conditions one is writing down. These definitions are just a bunch of boundary conditions, just like the definition of sky is a bunch of boundary conditions. So we say it's not non-expanding surface, and this captures the idea that it is actually isolated to the first order, if you like, because it is saying that nothing is falling into it. So in that sense, it is isolated. And now there is a condition 3b, and that's it. But before I write down the condition 3b, let me just write down a couple of consequences of the condition 3a. What does it imply? Well, as you might imagine, this actually expansion-free null surfaces are rather rare. I mean, they are, it's a strong condition, and so you would imagine that there are sort of rich consequences of this condition, and that is indeed the case. So, if you use Rai-Chaudhuri equation and the energy condition that I wrote down, then it immediately implies, so 2 plus Rai-Chaudhuri equation, these two immediately imply that shear of L also vanishes. And as a result of this, you can, this is sort of a, for those who know about all this null formalism, but the important thing is the following, that what you can now show is that if you take the metric GAB, space-time 4 metric, and I pull it back to this null surface, so I'll get some intrinsic degenerate metric on the null surface. Yeah, right? I mean, it's a null surface, so there's an intrinsic metric which is degenerate. So this metric, so this is the definition, and from now on, I'm going to write down this hats. And the hats would only mean that this equality holds just on this point. So there is no condition outside the boundary. These conditions are all just holding at the boundary. So this implies that that Li-L of QAB is equal to zero. So you have got a metric, the intrinsic geometry is stationary. It doesn't change in time. So the area of this apparent horizons, as you would expect in particular, doesn't change in time, or scalar curvature of this metric or anything like that. And so this metric, of course, is plus zero plus plus signature is degenerate, and QAB LB is equal to zero. This is the degenerate direction, is just the L direction. But there is a second interesting consequence, and the second interesting consequence is that there is a derivative operator also well defined. You see, normally, if you have a metric, you have a unique covariant derivative operator. But if the metric is degenerate, so it's not really metric, then it's not true that you have a unique covariant derivative operator. You can have a bunch of derivative operators. There's infinite number of derivative operators which will be compatible with them. But what happens in this case is that you can actually start with the space-time derivative operator, and let me not write down the definition. The space-time derivative operator, which we have uniquely given by this GAD, it can be pulled back in an unambiguous way because the shear is zero and the expansion is zero, to obtain a derivative operator just on the surface up here. Does anybody want any more detail? Or? No. Okay. So the statement is that you get a metric which is sitting out there, and you also get an intrinsic derivative operator sitting up here. That is just a fact coming from here. And I'll explain all this in Newman-Penrose notation, which one of my people might be more familiar with in just 1 minute. And the second condition is that this derivative operator, this connection, should also be Lie derived by a null vector field L up here. Yeah.
Is the derivative operator just the one you get by taking
the derivative back? Yeah, it is, but you have to make sure that it is actually unambiguous. It's exactly. Just take that. But then the thing is that I can have two, for example, covector fields, which pull back the same covector field here. And you want to make sure that if I now take that derivative operator and pull back that derivative, I get the same answer. Yeah, well, on sky, it's even slightly stronger, but here sort of the minimum condition is satisfied here. On sky, it's a little bit stronger, basically. On sky, the null normal that you have is actually, n that you have, is grad a and a equal to 0. I mean, nb equal to 0. You get a very strong. Here, this can still have an acceleration, but shear vanishing and expansion vanishing is enough to get the data.
No, it's not.
If I have a space time, then I have radiation.
going out, and I have a little bit of back setup, and a little bit is falling in later on, and that would make one.
Yeah, so this is an idealization, and as I was just telling you, there are two things that we know. One thing is just null initial, the double initial value, null initial value formulation. And afterwards, I can tell you exactly how much free data you can specify on one surface. This is the horizon, and the other null surface. You can specify freely certain data, and you will get a solution in some neighborhood up here. So that problem is well posed, and there's no problem in constructing such things. Now, the second thing is that there are examples, like as I was just telling you, Robinson-Trautmann solution, where this is true. In the physical applications, this may be an idealization, this may not be an idealization. That again depends on, you know, once you check what happens right in the physical applications. Is that the expansion is not really changing in late times? It's one of those things, like, it's the same kind of question. Is cry an idealization, or in physical problems, will there be logarithmic terms, will you spoil the, it's a similar kind of question. And the 3B is just that Liel of dA minus dA of Liel of any vector field KB equal to zero. Okay, so this is the definition. This is the complete definition. Yeah.
If I remember correctly, the last time I heard you talk about it, there was a different condition for 3B involving sort of the n, the inverse going vector. Yeah.
No, I'll just tell you what the equivalent. So this is much more general than what I talked about last time. This includes rotation, distortion, everything. So this is really the general case. Completely different. Last time I was talking about undistorted, non-rotating case. Yeah, it probably will satisfy that. So if you have a killing vector field, right? I mean, if you have a killing vector field, you're asking that the intrinsic metric will be derived. If this is true, then okay. And we're asking that derivative operator will be derived. And the derivative operator is really the one which is given by the four-dimensional one. Now, if you have a real killing vector field, I mean, a genuine killing vector field in space-time, then it will satisfy these conditions, right? Yeah, one can write down the whole, exactly. The conditions are rather weak, but nonetheless, you can prove rich enough structure, and now one might specialize. Okay, so now the question is, what is the meaning of these conditions? And this might be sort of interesting case. So what this condition says is the following. This condition implies truth. Well, actually, yeah, this implies truth. And this is really what we need. What we need is Liel of, there's a Newman-Penrose coefficient called mu equal to 0. I'll define what mu is, and Liel of pi equal to 0. Where mu is just defined to be equal to is the expansion of the other vector field n. You have that null vector field, and what this condition, these two conditions, 3a and 3b, imply is that there exists a foliation. Many of them, there exists foliation, such that if I give you a foliation, you get a vector field n. Right, and this is L, and you get N up here. And this condition just say that the expansion of this inward normal, okay, is constant in time, doesn't change. And the second condition is this object has no obvious, has no name attached to it. It is just equal to LA and B grad A and B. So it is just certain components of the connection. So what one is saying is that So I could have replaced this condition by a condition which says that there exists a foliation such that if I now construct N and M and M bar with respect to that foliation, then these two Newman-Penrose quantities are actually constant in time. That's what one is saying. What is the physics of these quantities? Well, the physics of these quantities is the following. As we'll see, do I have to make any other remarks here? So, what is the physics of this quantity? So this is the definition, and now I'm already in the called general structure.
Yes. There's the Weingarten nut. The second fundamental form has always
exists if you don't take it as a quadratic form, but as a map on the tangent space, which is called the Van Garten map, and which exists for null horizon. So are you saying that, like the other, so there is always like a definite first fundamental form, and then there is this second form, which is not a form, because it is...
I don't know, I mean, I'm not...
Are you saying it is just the... which is the part of the connection which is basically defining the thing. So are you saying you are
re-transporting
both the first
fundamental
form and the
Van Garten? I would think so, but I'm not, because I also knew about this. I was a student, and I had forgotten about it. Thanks for reminding. We can check it very quickly.
This thing function which satisfies the Navier-Stokes equation, and we derive all the membrane things of the black hole, what would viscosity would show up and what would vary when you have the influx or not, then there was this Navier-Stokes equation which was the derivative of the Van Garten map is equal to something coming in. So are you saying that it's set to zero what is coming in?
Yeah, it's certainly we're setting to zero what is coming in. The area is not changing, for example, the, or even the area element is not changing. So that's the idea.
Equation, because there is the right scheduler equation is an equation for the evolution of the
Else.
Area of this, and right. Then there was an evolution for a vector quantity which is linked to the second fundamental Van Garten map.
Yeah. It is it's very likely, I mean, the sense that they. There may be some technical difference, like I mean, I'm cheating here slightly. For example, I wrote it correctly. I said this equation is equivalent to that, implies this equation. But this equation has one more condition up here. And what we really need is just these two equations. Okay, I mean, it is that Liel of the shear of N is also zero. That's the third thing that is. But what we really need is these two conditions. But I'm just not going into all sorts of detail. So roughly speaking, it should be the same. Whether it is exactly the same, I don't know. So we should check that. Two in up and
one.
Down, sorry.
So there is a form which you're saying by differentiating the normal, which is the mixed form. And for case like I just suggested, this is like the second fundamental form, but this form exists for any measure.
This is a special case of what you're saying, because this is not, this is co-dimension one still. What you're talking about can exist even if the co-dimension is not one.
Okay,
so let me just now talk about the general structure, and there already we sort of want to get intuition for these conditions. Okay, what do they all mean? So, physics or general structure. Okay, so this is... to appear. So what this is just telling us is the following. First of all, the condition, this condition 3a that I have, this already implies that psi 0 and psi 1, these wild tensor components vanish. So in that sense, there's no radiation going in. This condition already implies that psi 0 and psi 1 are equal to 0. For those who may not remember, psi 0 is equal to c. Let me not write ABCD. ABCD are always here. C times LM, and psi 1 is equal to C times LM. 2L. No. L is a repeated principal notation, right? And furthermore, but psi 2 is not equal to 0, as you might imagine. Of course, psi 2 is not equal to 0. And psi 2 in general will have a real part, and you will have an imaginary part. Okay. Now, it turns out that, as we'll see in a minute, the real part of psi 2, as you might imagine, has the mass information. And the imaginary part of psi 2 has angular momentum information. I mean, it's more or less clear looking at what happens in curve solution, for example, that is the case. But it is, but there are many ways to sort of, one has a lot of intuition from, you know, from basically asymptotic analysis people did to think of the size. So one expects the imaginary part of psi 2 to have the angular momentum information and psi. Now, if psi 2 is real, I will come back to that in a second, and it turns out that psi 3 is also equal to 0, and psi 3 is equal to c times L, is it L number? LN. I know which one should go, but I just never know which order they should go. Okay. But there are to be two ends. And then finally, Psi 4 will have NMNM. So Psi 3 is equal to 0, but this is arbitrary. This is 0 in vacuum. If it is not vacuum, then this is completely given by the stress energy tensor, and this is arbitrary. So this is sort of the Psi 4 is a free data that you can specify on this surface, if you like, in null initial value formulation. Okay. Now, if I now look at this this size, let me consider a simple case in which imaginary part of psi 2 is equal to 0. Well, in general, let me not assume that. In general, imaginary part of psi 2 has a potential, and that potential is this pi that I wrote down before. So it's really x or something like pi. Angular derivatives of pi give you imaginary part of psi 2. We'll talk about the linear. It's very good. Right. So how it has to. I want to come back to that. There's a whole subject about linear momentum in a second. So imaginary part of psi 2 is equal to this potential up here. Now, for most of the talk, I would like to, just for time reason, I would like to really talk about the case when there is no angular momentum and come to these questions like linear momentum, etc. And at the very end, I'll just tell you the formulae that come about for angular momentum. When you include rotation, what happens? Okay. So the statement up here is that, so let me assume that imagine the part of psi 2 equal to 0. Then you can easily check that this pi is pure gauge. If you do it in terms of spin, then in fact, imagine part of psi 2 is equal to 0. It just says that certain 2 form, like Maxwell-like 2 form, on the curvature is 0. Is 0, and pi is a vector potential. You can construct a vector field out of pi, and there is vector potential for that. So it's really saying that I got a Maxwell field strength at FAB equal to 0, and there is a potential, let's call it pi A, which is with F equal to d pi, which is given to you. So you might as well put pi equal to 0. So if you put pi equal to 0, so the statement is that if this is the case, you can actually, just by gauge transformation basically, by choice of n, you can put So this is a gauge choice. By gauge choice, I mean choice of n. N A is sort of depends on which foliation you choose, and this is n. And the very nice general result is that with this gauge choice, there is a unique foliation. So now, we're given this manifold delta, and we're given a unique foliation of this manifold delta. So we're given a preferred foliation, which is, of course, is mapped into itself by L. Okay, it's mapped into, this foliation is preserved by the vector field L that we have. Now, if you have a preferred foliation that is given to you, you can think of it as a rest frame. So, therefore, this really defines the rest frame of the event horizon, of the isolated horizon. I really can't tell if an isolated horizon has free momentum or not in absolute terms. I will tell you with respect to whom. Even at infinity, I can't tell if you give me space-time, not initial data, but just space-time, ask, is there a free momentum? That is not a meaningful statement. I can tell you it is a free momentum. You give me a rest frame, then I'll tell you it has a free momentum or not. The same thing is true up here. So what we could do is, we could take, this is what one would really do in numerical relativity, one would actually take some Cauchy slice, see where this Cauchy slice is going to intersect this surface. If the Cauchy slice intersects the three surface in pi equal to 0 surface, I'll justify all this in a minute. I'm just telling you the final answers to get the feeling. If this Cauchy slice intersects the horizon, okay, on this pi equal to 0 surface up here, then we would say that the horizon has, that with respect to this initial data set, the horizon is not moving. The horizon is at rest. Statement is that if Cauchy slice, partial Cauchy slice M intersects delta in a pi equal to 0 slice surface. By the way, this is not trivial, that there always exists foliation which satisfies this, and that foliation is unique. So it's a very nice geometrical result. And therefore, so if you are given a S prime, or if you like a fictitious world line in some space, if you like, parametrized by time, pi equal to 0 surface, then we'll say no momentum. Yeah. I don't think that this, there will be a problem here, but I haven't really thought too much about the uniqueness issue. No, I don't think there's a problem. We'll talk about it. All
right.
We'll talk about this. Okay. I mean, it could be that my answer was just given to you by 3 minutes of thinking, so maybe I missed something. So, sure. Okay. So this is surface. So there is a three momentum up here. No three momentum. Now, and you can check, of course, you know, if you take Schwarzschild space-time, and write down in the Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates like Masner and Mijan and a third author did, then of course the normal slicing is such that pi is equal to 0 up here. But now one can take a boosted slice, right? We can take a boosted slice in the Eddington-Finkelstein. So I'm using blue for boosted. Then the surface will be something like that. And then, of course, it's not one of these pi equal to 0 slices. There is a boost relative to here. But you can map this slice, the blue slice, to this slice, or the red slices to the blue slice via a boost parameter in general. And the free momentum, I don't have a final expression. I know how to do it, but I have not written down. The free momentum is completely given by that boost parameter up here. So there is an this is not done yet, but I mean it's a matter of a day or so just to make sure that all the factors are right. There is going to be an expression of what the three momentum is relative to an initial data set. So this is the structure. Yeah. So the thing is that under boost you can write down how pi changes, and that change is going to capture the momentum. So, but from now on, I will assume that I'm going to set pi equal to 0. And all my results are really referring to pi equal to 0 slicing. If I want, I can always go back and transform them via boosting to general slice. This is non-rotating case. In addition to, I'll talk about rotation at the end. In the case of the rotating case also, there is a preferred slicing. Sort of in that slicing, that black hole has only angular momentum, but no linear momentum. Okay, so I mean spin angular momentum, but no orbital motion. So let's now assume that pi is equal to 0. Now what we can do is, and this is basically construction due to Lewandowski. Well, Lewandowski did in the general case, even including the rotation. So in this case, what one can do is, one has this isolated horizon. So again, this is, you think of this as something that is happening in the distant future up here. So I take this isolated horizon, and what Lewandowski says is, well, look, this isolated horizon is really coming to us with a slicing, and this slicing is intrinsically determined because it's a property of the geometry. I can go and, it's not coordinate property on the other side, I can just go and calculate pi, and I know, thanks to this nice theorem, which says there exists a unique slicing. So it doesn't matter whether you slice or you slice, you'll get exactly the same slicing, you're not going to get two. Then the idea is the obvious one, and this really is completely analogous to the boundary expansions, namely, now you just look at null surfaces which are coming out. So the statement is that here you have got a green vector, which is L. And now this is pi equal to 0 slice. And now what you can do is you can just look at your vector field NA. I wrote the vector field NA to be future directed. Just look at it past directed. So I'll get everywhere here a vector field, just minus of NA, if you like. Everywhere, and then you just take geodesics that are emanating from here, and now we have at each point up here we can fix, I mean on the horizon we already have L, we already have N, and we can just choose an M and M bar. It is up to us. There's a gauge freedom, that there is a, this is the ordinary gauge rotation. In other words, I got this orthonormal diode, and I can just rotate it and obtain another orthonormal diode. And the statement is that I can just parallel propagate them everywhere, and at any given point up here, I will again have a vector field N, which is going to be null, I'm going to have a vector field which is a minus n, if you like, which is going to be null. Then there's going to be a vector field L, and here I'm going to have vector fields n and m bar, or x and y. The real and imaginary part will give me two vectors. So everywhere up here, I'll get a nice null tetrad. And now this is really an invariant tetrad. And Lewandowski has been able to write down, for example, field equations. In other words, you have vector coefficients, you know, expansion parameters. And you can write down the field equations and see what the field equations imply to all these coefficients. And so if you're given a geometry, I mean, one can actually, this is an invariantly defined object. And for example, the answer to Bernie Schuster's question would be, for example, I would like to see the plot of psi 4 in this tetrad. And then I would think that it has some invariant meaning, which of course I would have to develop more physical feeling for. But this is a universal prescription. It is not going to depend on which coordinate system you express something in to begin with, or what, if you started with a Brill wave, or if you started with two black holes. There's just a universal prescription, and we can plot the same quantity, and we can compare it anyways. This is very much in the spirit of Bondi expansions. And when you write down the expand of the metric coefficients, there is a very close. This is invariant. So for example, if the space-time were to admit any killing vector whatsoever, of course that killing vector, first of all, will be always tangential. Its restriction to the isolated horizon will be tangential just by, because it cannot move the isolated horizon. I mean, the isolated horizons are isolated. And then it will, the action outside will have to map, will necessarily map this structure that I have produced, namely the tetrads that I have produced and the foliation that I have produced to itself. So it is really an invariant object that is given to you, and therefore you can use it in your calculations. Okay. So now, let me just tell you the answers about the third part, which is what are the mass and angular momentum formulae. And they turn out to be incredibly simple. I didn't believe that they would be so simple to begin with. Yeah. I didn't even know that. Okay. So this is the part, this is the work he did in the 80s, I think, right?
Yeah.
Thanks very much. I did not know. Thank you. Okay, now the formula for mass and angular momentum. Now, there are many subtleties, and those of you who are more mathematical oriented, sort of, you know, or are interested more in fundamental questions like, you know, what is the meaning of the laws of black hole mechanics and so on, we can discuss this later. What I think we have time, all I'm going to do is to just tell you what the procedure is and what the final result is, and not worry about that. Okay. So what is the procedure? The procedure is what I told you before, that what we are going to do is we are going to be given this accelerated horizon. So now I'm going to assume that I'm given some initial data, and furthermore, this initial slice intersects this two sphere, okay, this in some surface up here, right, in pi equal to zero surface. Now, as a side remark, which is going to be useful in a second, I mean, I looked at these two Newman-Penrose coefficients. If pi is equal to zero, then actually the shear actually is zero, and we don't have to really worry about shear at all. So the only important Newman-Penrose coefficients, the only important connection components are mu and pi in this case. And now, if pi is equal to zero, you can ask, what is the meaning of mu? What mu causes is distortion. So in the older work that you were talking about a few months ago, we are assuming pi is equal to zero, and we're assuming that mu is spherically symmetric. So if mu is spherical, then there is no distortion. That means that QAD has spherical symmetry, is a spherical metric, is a sphere metric, or scalar curvature of QAD is constant. But if mu is not spherically symmetric, mu has some YLMs in them, in general it can have any YLMs in them, then in fact, the Gauss curvature will not be constant, and you will get these distorted black holes, and which are of course very important for numerical relativity. I mean, even when things are settled down, it may be that it is distorted, for example, because there may be some matter rings outside, or there may be something sitting on outside. There are, of course, there's a large literature on distorted black holes, and all that literature is a subcase of what we're doing up here. I mean, all the results we're talking about actually follow. For example, from the Hamiltonian formulation, which is now going to give us the mass and angular momentum formula in a minute, it's a consequence of the Hamiltonian formulation, for example, that in all these cases that we're looking at, that people have looked at, the surface gravity will always be given by 1 upon 2r. In other words, surface gravity would be independent of the function mu, would be independent of distortion. Even on distorted black holes, the surface gravity doesn't depend on distortion at all. It just depends on the area, which in the beginning was a surprising result, but this is just a sort of little lemma, or is a consequence of the general framework up here. Okay, so now let me just tell you what the idea is. So the idea is basically we want to do the Hamiltonian formulation. And I would like to compute what is the Hamiltonian generating a time translation. If you give me a vector field in a physical space-time, I can calculate what the Hamiltonian vector field is, or what the Hamiltonian is. So you give me some vector field TA up here, which when you go out to infinity, supposing at infinity is a nice asymptotic time translation, if this time translation happens to be in the rest frame, then there will be no three momentum and the energy will be equal to mass. Otherwise, you'll just get energy, and then you'll have to add momentum to get the mass. And now, on the horizon, we're going to assume that it coincides with this LA. In other words, we've got this rest frame, and at the horizon, we want to make sure that these pi equal to zero surfaces are mapped into each other, so we've got this vector field LA. So we just take a vector field in space-time, which satisfies this boundary condition, and then you work out what the Hamiltonian is. And then the Hamiltonian has a volume term, which is made of constraints, bunch of constraints, plus you'll get a surface term at infinity, and you get a surface term at the horizon. This is just a general form of the Hamiltonian. You just do the detailed calculation, and that's what we found, what one finds. This, to nobody's surprise, is the ADM energy, or the ADM mass, if you are in the rest frame. And the idea, as I was telling you before, is to think of this as being the mass of the horizon. Now, this general framework is what we use, for example. I mean, there are many reasons to do that. Hamiltonian framework gives us, when you have space-times, which are several asymptotic regions, you calculate the total Hamiltonian, gives you something, and there are boundary terms in each of these asymptotic regions, and you take that boundary term to mean the mass associated with that asymptotic region. So what we want to do is exactly the same thing here. We want to take this surface term as being the mass associated with the horizon. Okay. So what is the formula for mass? The formula for mass, well, let me write down first a formula for the ADM energy. For the formula for the ADM energy, in a certain way, we write it in terms of the Weyl tensor components rather than the metric components, is limit as you take the radius of the surface equal to infinity, here r equal to constant, of r times psi 2 times g2v. This is the formula for the ADM momentum, ADM mass, if you write it in terms of Weyl component psi 2. And so, I mean, to me it was a surprise that the term up here, m delta, turns out to be precisely the following. It is equal to, there is a 1 upon 4 pi g here. Here also there is a 1 upon 4 pi g times minus 1 upon mu times psi 2. In Schwarzschild space-time, if there is no distortion, if mu is spherical, then this 1 minus 1 upon mu is precisely minus 1 upon, minus 1 upon mu is just plus 1 upon r. So 1 upon mu is just r. So in Schwarzschild space-time, this formula just looks like r times psi 2 evaluated on the horizon, whereas the formula up here looks like r times psi 2 evaluated infinity. There's a complete similarity between the two formulae.
So in this setup, was not sigma
is 0 because this is the shear free L is 0, right? So there's no radiation. So it is like what happens at Skra, except that there is news is zero, if you like. Exactly. So that's what I would like to this result that we're supposed to check. So we got this here, and we got this up here. And now, but in general, it looks like that. But there's even a more further nice simplification for numerical relativity, namely, this in a general space, in a Schwarzschild space-time, this is spherical and psi 2 is spherical. But in general space-time, this is non-spherical and this is non-spherical. But nonetheless, the two together, so to say, the total integral in the general space-time is just equal to 1 upon 4 pi g times the radius of the horizon. In other words, you would have thought the Schwarzschild mass is just given by r by 2, right? Yeah. The Schwarzschild mass is just given by the Schwarzschild radius by 2, r by 2, right? The same formula is true even in the distorted cases. All you have to do is to calculate the area, and that does give you this quantity, the horizon mass. So this is a mathematical equality. I mean, one has to show that you have to show two things. One is that the surface term is given by this. This is a detailed functional analysis kind of thing. I mean, not rigorous, but functional analysis, the Hamiltonian framework. And then one has to show differential identity, and it is really true that the total mass is just given by 1 upon 4 pi g or 1 upon 8 pi g times the radius of the horizon. Square root of the area, right, exactly. So the statement is that the area of the horizon is just equal to 4 pi r delta square, which, if mu is non-spherical, then of course this doesn't, I mean, you know, this is just a definition. It's not a spherical symmetric thing, it's just a, yeah. No, I think Minkowski's best. D by dt plus d by dz. Yeah, so psi 2 is 0, so let's have 0 bar, right?
So the mass is 0, so that's fine. But now, is the radius also 0? Or, I mean, it sounds like it should have a radius just like the radius on 0 or something. Unless I'm missing something. You want to translate by d by dt and d by d phi?
No,
yeah,
d.
d by dt plus d by dz. Plain old, yeah.
But that doesn't give you a sphere. That doesn't give you S2 cross R.
Are you sticking it?
No.
You're sleeping. don't think of it this time. You missed the argument. Yeah, so let me just think about it. There's something wrong somewhere. I mean, I better.
Right.
Right. No, I think.
It looks like it should have zero mass and psi 2 is 0.
Right.
But I don't quite see. So from the formula, then it sounds like the radius should be 0.
I think in that case, psi 2 is 0 and mu is also 0, right?
Oh, I
think you're saying. Yeah, so mu is also 0. So you're right, I did miss out a condition, and the condition was. Good, you caught me. The condition that is not really being considered here anyway, because we are. For future horizons, I mean, that's. There's a condition on mu. I should just talk about this just a little bit. Exactly to rule out these, as well as the white hole horizon. One would like to rule out the white hole horizon from this analysis, because an Hamiltonian formulation doesn't mean anything, and so on. So there is a condition which says, thank you, which says that mu is strictly less than zero. There is a condition up here, and that is mu is strictly right, exactly, and that is really not satisfying. Yeah.
I can take many spherical triangles of Schwarzschild solution, and the area.
I'm not saying this is true anywhere. I'm just saying this is true at the horizon.
But this is a spherical slice through Schwarzschild. You know, and you can make, by any given Schwarzschild, you can make the probe as small as it seems, just depending on where you want it to go.
That's right. This is pi equal to zero slicing up here.
Yeah,
it will not, I mean, it's not true, for example, even if I take just boosted slicing, this condition is not violated. This condition is violated. That one could write out a formula in general, right? I mean, what the mass is. But, I mean, just making an appropriate transformation from pi equal to zero slice to that. Yeah.
So this is what can be called the irreducible mass?
It's in curved space-time, for example, it is not really, I mean, it's just a mass.
Correct, it's a mass, but it is the quantity which, I guess Christodoulou or somebody originally called the irreducible mass, but
it's
the square root of the area.
All right. Okay, so in the non-rotating case, it is the irreducible mass. Right? In the non-rotating case, it will be the irreducible mass. Right.
Okay, I mean, his argument initially was that the area can't be free, and if it's going to settle down to 4 chill, you get a 4 chill, which is a given mass. So that's the mass that the 4 chill black hole of this area would have.
Right. So the statement is that if it is a vacuum, and because it is, none of these things are true if there is, for example, electromagnetic field, Young-Mills field, etc. At infinity, there is no contribution from these fields, but on the horizon, there are additional terms which are very similar to that that come up here. So if there is vacuum, so we don't have this problem. And if it is non-rotating, then that argument will give that. Right. I was just confusing with the rotating case. In the rotating case, you would get some other results. You will not get just the area. Yeah. Right. This is exactly one of the discussion points, and I'll come back to that. You asked me all the questions that I want to discuss. Let me just sort of, so this is the mass, and let me just tell you that. Right. No. H is not zero. Right, exactly. Yes, I'll tell you just the statement. Right. The result that we have. Certainly restricted result, but the following. This is the last property that I want to discuss about the mass, and then for angular momentum I just want to write down the formula. Okay. So the result is the following. I could have kept that picture also. Take one of these pictures and look at the distant future. Okay, this picture is better for my drawing purpose. The result is now that given this, we're assuming that there is a solution here. So therefore in this little corner up here, there is a solution of Einstein's equation. Then I can take a slice through the surface, right? Space-like slice through the surface, which I call M. And I can evaluate what the mass up here is. I can evaluate the ADM mass, and there's a difference. So H, as you say, is equal to M ADM minus M delta. And we want to know what this H is. Now, we make some assumptions about the behavior are the fields near I plus, which I can explain to you in technical detail in a minute. And that's certainly an assumption at this stage. I mean, I don't have any differential equations, existence, or anything which will tell me. But it is basically saying that the I plus looks like Schwarzschild, very, very roughly. Then the little theorem is that this H is equal to precisely the integral of energy through square. So it is really N squared, Bondi nu squared. So what one does is one uses Hamiltonian methods in order to relate this and this and that. So that's exactly the result that various people were asking for. So this is the kind of result that Bernie was using, but what I'm saying here is that this is very much in the same spirit, but one is giving ADM mass, you knew what it was. I'm giving a precise notion of this mass, which you don't have to go and, you know, optimize. Sorry, you did it for the rotating case, and I have not written down the formula for the rotating case, but there is a formula. If you use that formula, then you don't have to go and optimize it with curve or anything like that. In terms of the geometry of that surface, one would be able to write down this. And then there is a little lemma. We said the difference between them is really the energy that is radiated through. So this can be used as the real check on the computation, what is happening in the computation. The last point that I want to talk about is just very briefly just write down the formula for the angular momentum. So now, what is J equal to? Now we assume pi is not equal to 0. Imagine if pi of psi 2 is not equal to 0. But I'm going to assume, but again, even in this case, there is a nice foliation that exists, and we're working with that foliation. One of the things that we do need to do, I think this is an answer to your previous question, was not really look at, write down a formula which is not only holds at pi equal to 0 slicing, but a formula which holds on every slicing. It is given any slice, there is a transformation property, and I will be able to write down this formula. We just haven't done that. I mean, there is a transformation property of how psi 2 transforms, how my mu transforms. So we'll just write down a formula which you can then apply to any slice. So we will be able to do that. It's just a matter of maybe a day's work or something. Okay. Now, angular momentum. Now, in this case, there does exist a slicing, and the slicing is given by the following condition. This is really the divergence of vector field pi A. And pi A is just obtained by taking pi times m A plus pi bar times m bar A. equal to 0. So we're just asking that, you see, as I was telling you, psi 2 with an epsilon AD is stuck to it, is like a Maxwell field. And pi with this vector is its potential. So what we're saying is that we want to fix the potential of this electromagnetic field such that its curl is, of course, unaffected. Its curl is really psi 2 up here. And to fix the potential, we just use the obvious gauge, you know, like the divergence free gauge that one always uses, often uses in E&M. This I'm less sure of. It could be that this should not be equal to 0, it should be something on the right-hand side, etc. But at the moment, all the calculations are done in this frame. This frame always exists, and unique. Slicing exists and is unique. Okay, on the horizon up here. This slicing exists and is unique. And now, you can write down the formula for the angular momentum. And again, there is some number here, which I don't. I think it's 4 pi g times integral of this pi a times phi a times d to v, where phi is a rotationally killing vector field. So the statement is that if in fact it is a non-rotating, if it is in fact a rotating case, then like in other statements, what it means is that there is an additional killing field on the horizon. For the intrinsic geometry of the horizon and intrinsic derivative operator, there is an additional geometry. And then the statement is that then, as in Hawking's theorem, one can show that that means that there is also a rotational killing vector field in addition. And the normalization of the rotational killing vector field is unique because we want it to go to the total affine length should be equal to 2 pi. You plug it in here and you will get the angular momentum to be equal to just pi a phi a up here. And if you think about it more, this pi a looks more and more like the local momentum density. I got this horizon, the round, and it's rotating, and at each point, if you like, there is a spatial momentum density, and what this is saying is that the horizon is not, there's no orbital motion here at all. When it's, this is, I should call it maybe spin, rather than say spin. The horizon is going round, and this is the angular momentum of the angular part of the momentum of the horizon times the rotational killing field, and that gives you the total thing. Okay.
Just also the motivation we have to go for using the subject pi a as the momentum density on the whole, and not including the dynamical situation in the field and the expansion is not zero that pi, but it's like exactly in an equal situation.
Ah. But this pi is the same pi, the Newman-Penrose
pi?
Fantastic.
I remember well now, because that work was after I checked, we looked at shear equal zero to my data, and he used the divergence of I to zero as the gauge system condition for pi in all cases. Well, it looks at this.
Yeah, I mean, you just told me. Okay, so now the thing is that, as I was telling you before, our main interest was really to make sure that the laws actually hold. So there are many confirmations that these are really good definitions. Some of them I already told you, that namely that the difference between them is the energy that is radiated away, which is positive, etc. But also, one can actually check that with these definitions, then laws of black hole mechanics actually hold. So this is a really big generalization of the standard laws of black hole mechanics, because the space of solutions with isolated horizons is really infinity-dimensional. There can be lots of radiation, etc., etc. Okay, so now the last part, and the last part is really about future directions, and here I'll tell you about a few points. Yeah, in the rotating case, it does change, right, exactly. No, it turns out to be, when you finally write it in terms of parameters, it's exactly the curve formula, in terms of the R and J. Okay, which parameter? That's important. It's the parameters are R and J, not R and A or something. R and J, you can write it in terms of R and J. It's exactly the same. Okay, so now the directions, I mean, there are obvious applications which are really to the equilibrium states, you know, the final states in this collapse. So these two black holes which collided and set us down, and one would like to calculate energy, momentum, etc. intrinsically without having to embed this little region into curved space-time and some other geometry, and just read off from local geometry all the physical information you want. And again, I think that this Bondi type frame, on which very little has been done so far, would be actually very useful in the numerical relativity. Now, there are several several issues. There are 2 points that I want to just mention. The first point is, so the first is, this is the obvious application to future to extract information. And the second is, use boundary type system to extract physics. I had no idea, for example, how far these boundary type systems go. For example, in this two black hole problem, right, if the two black holes merge, and I look at equilibrium situation up here, and I got this slicing up here, then the boundary type system can go in distant paths. And they can go in different paths. So, I mean, of course, further you go, further you are from the black hole, but it could be that these boundary time systems actually do cover interesting regions where there's a lot of radiation, for example, traversing this region up here. It's quite possible, and that would be good to extract that. The not so obvious things, and here I think a lot of input would be very appreciated. One is, what one would like to do is to maybe given initial data for two black holes now. So think of the initial data up here. I mean, somehow, some sense one would like to know how much radiation there is in the initial data set. For example, the ones that Jimmy has produced, on your emission initial data sets, and there's an issue about how much radiation there is. And again, it may be that these issues are not on the forefront importance to numerical relativity, but it's good to clarify. And I think there are some conceptual problems which I don't know how to solve, and so maybe you can help me. So what I can do is, I could perhaps tell you, given such a slice, what the momentum of this particular black hole is. I could talk about, say, non-rotating case for simplicity. I could talk about momentum of this black hole up here. But I don't know, and of course I'll tell you what the energy is in each case. No problem with that. Energy and momentum, I can tell you about that. But I would like to be able to also say then that somehow we also know the ADM momentum. We also know ADM energy. But from here, one would like to say that somehow there is some difference or something like that, that actually will give us the amount of radiation here. And I have no idea about how to really do that. The analysis we did, when there is only one black hole, the analysis we can do in the future. In the future, I can do an analysis in which I can take the ADM, I can subtract out this, and then I can say that the difference is really the energy that is radiated away. That really assumed this business about I plus, that I plus looks like Schwarzschild up here. The I minus doesn't look like Schwarzschild at all, right? Because there are two black holes coming in. It looks very different. And so it's not clear to me at all how to do this problem. Right? It could be just a technical issue in some sense, and maybe one might be able to. But there are clearly physical issues also, because as soon as the two of them, then you don't expect the differences between energies or momentum or energy momentum to give you the energy momentum that is radiated away. Maybe there is some Coulombic, here is in fact some Coulombic attraction energy which is not really in the radiation field and such thing. I don't have very good ideas as to what to do after that. I mean, already there is some work to provide you with simple expressions for P and E. P and E given such an initial data set. It's not too much work, but it's some work. Yeah, you could compute rest mass, but you could. I don't have a closed formula for P, but basically by reading off the pi on this slicing. But that's exactly right. So this is the momentum related to this hypersurface, right? This hypersurface condition. It is a generalization of what one would do in Schwarzschild.
Yes.
No, and I think finally I would write it out intrinsically here. I don't have to. I mean.
But it's
by no. Okay. So there will be super momentum. That's what you're talking about. In general, there will be super momentum, but there will be first three components which you would like to call as momentum. How useful it is, I don't know. I mean, it's like what happens at null infinity. I mean, it's right. There will be right. Why is it not smooth?
Because in this situation,
no, but I'm not doing analysis up here. I'm doing analysis either here or here.
Yeah, but if you have one point which is non-smooth, so where's it?
No, it doesn't matter. It's local constructions. These are local constructions. Right? Sorry. It is not smooth all the way down up here. So if that is the case, then how are we evolving the black holes? I'm giving you initial data, right? And they're going to collide at some stage. But these are not event horizons. These are not event horizons. Sorry, I mean, maybe there's a point. This is precisely what is getting away from the event horizons. But this is sort of say the world trajectory of. Maybe I should not even draw this. Yeah, that's how we should write. That's exactly. I was about to do exactly that. Right? So I should just say this. Right? There's some stuff happens. Black box happens here. You are given evolution here. You are given evolution here. And as you say, here some jump occurred. So and this is a dynamical region. And I'm like, yeah, that's exactly. Okay. And the last thing was really, and maybe there are some ideas along here from what Thibault was talking about. This is probably the work that you did for your thesis eta or something, right? Is that right? Yeah. Okay. So maybe that'll be good to see what one can take over from there. Is really this idea of what happens in dynamical situations. Now, these dynamical situations are not event horizons. So what are the generalizations of this? Because I don't want to wait. I mean, problems like what you said, and I don't want to wait forever. There are these ideas of Sean Hayward's tracking horizons. Which are generalizations of this. I mean, he didn't do the detailed analysis, but the definition is a generalization of this. And probably these are things that are very suitable for what you do numerically, because the world lines of this apparent horizon will constitute one of these trapping horizons. In the expanding phase, the trapping horizons are space-like, and they become null only if there is no matter flux and if the shear is zero. The shear of the L is zero, then they become null. So these are really special cases of his horizons. These are the non-dynamical. So he has some general definition and some qualitative, some interesting results, but they're somewhat limited. But I think that one should be able to really take the trapping horizons of Hayward. They're locally defined, and that's exactly what you would do in numerical relativity. And now this will be the interesting part in which one would like to be able to do dynamics, or the dynamical stuff, right, near the trapping horizons. So they're space-like, they're expanding, and so one should be able to write down balance laws. One should say that, just like at null infinity, I got this cross-section, the energy and momentum is this, I got this cross-section, the energy and momentum is this, and then what the difference is equal to what fell in to the horizon. And I think one would be able to do all these things. But this is not an easy problem, but I'm fairly confident. It just needs to understand the framework, mathematics of it. The first problem, which is really extracting, telling you how much radiation there is or something like that, that requires some conceptual and physical input. Thank you. Nothing in numerical relativity. Right.
What would be best though? Would it be best to sort of, you know, look at the null guys and not worry about the expansion, or look at the trapping guys?
That's different physics, right? So we should look at both. So the statement would be what we understood is the simple case as usual, you know, the non-dynamical case in which the intrinsic geometry is non-dynamical. That's what one has understood. One way to look at all this is that, you know, all the laws of black hole mechanics, one uses killing vector is very, very strongly, and this is the realization that in fact what you need is something very weak restriction of killing vector fields. And it crystallizes exactly what you need. If you drop any of these conditions, laws of black hole mechanics are at home. And what we need is just this, that the mu should be less than zero for a future horizon. This will be automatically the case. And then you'll have got this vanish and this equal to zero. Right? These are the conditions that we have. This one's right. So you could take this evolution, and this framework will be useful in distant future. Right? This framework will be useful in distant future. But if you wanted to really know what is happening as the black holes are approaching each other, in that case, one really would have to use a trapping horizon, because then in that case the trajectories of apparent horizons would be space-like. Yeah, Peter?
I guess the scale of the apparent horizon would be another hypothesis. It's a measure for how close you are to things like space.
Yeah, that's another one. Good. Yeah. And another, I mean, an easy thing to do is to do perturbation theory on this, and that will be rather easy to do. Okay, thank you very much.